Our next speaker today will be Stephen Smoot. Stephen is a graduate of BYU in Ancient Near Eastern Studies, is a doctoral student at the Hebrew, not the Hebrew University, but the Catholic University of America, and is currently adjunct professor in religious education at BYU. His presentation today is on the temple in the Book of Abraham. Stephen?
Before I begin, ladies and gentlemen, my apologies if I start coughing up a lung. I've been fighting a cold and a cough for the last week and a half, and it's winning the fight. So I apologize if I sound raspy or start coughing. Hopefully not, though. The other thing I'll just mention briefly here is that this is a pared down version of a bigger paper that I'm working on here. So hopefully when the proceedings get published, you can see the fuller version of my remarks, because there's a lot to say about this fascinating subject. But we will proceed. The hermeneutical tradition of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints bears unmistakable witness to the sustained interest in reading scripture through the perspective of the temple. Both the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses and the Pearl of Great Price have received this exegetical treatment, with a variety of authors offering useful approaches that discern clear temple themes in Latter-day Saint scriptural texts. That Joseph Smith's scriptural translations, as well as his revelatory outpouring, directly influenced the form and content of the temple endowment ceremony, as experienced by Latter-day Saints, cannot be doubted. For this reason, the Latter-day Saint canon will continue to be explored for meaningful themes and elements that tie into both ancient and modern temples. Besides the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses, which have commanded the attention of many Latter-day Saint exegetes, the Book of Abraham in the Pearl of Great Price is also replete with temple themes. This book, however, has received comparatively minimal hermeneutical analysis as a temple text. With a few exceptions, Latter-day Saints have typically neglected the Book of Abraham in their discussion of temple texts. This is unfortunate, since, as Terrell Givens has rightly observed, the Book of Abraham that Joseph Smith produced was a small text, but it was seminal in the development of his mature theological enterprise. This, Givens recognizes, includes the development of Joseph Smith's temple theology, or his grand theological project involving the ordinances of the temple, that was the summit, the culmination of his entire work of restoration. This paper seeks to provide a few examples of just how the Book of Abraham can be read as a temple text, or otherwise how the temple and temple themes feature in the text. So before we proceed any further, a simple working definition of temple text and temple themes is in order. Jeffrey M. Bradshaw, whose contributions to Latter-day Saint temple theology remains indispensable, has provided an effective definition of this category. Drawing on the work of scholars John W. Welch and Margaret Barker, Bradshaw defines temple theology as a branch of theology that concerns itself with encountering God or the divine through the signs, symbols, patterns, and ritual instructions of the temple. A temple text, then, is a text that is infused narratively, thematically, and even structurally with the presence of the temple and temple-related patterns, while temple themes are those elements in the text that show a conceptual linkage with the temple. Extending this definition, a temple text is a text that captures themes, motifs, teachings, or allusions to the temple. A text that grounds its narrative and cosmology in the temple or in sacred space, and a text that interplays with the temple ritual and vice versa. My approach to the Book of Abraham as a temple text in this paper highlights two aspects of what makes the book such. The first is how the temple or the idea of sacred space features in the text itself. As we shall see, temple elements are depicted throughout the story and told in the pages of the Book of Abraham, where at key moments, these elements are embedded or otherwise prominently featured. The second aspect is how the text in its canonical form interplays with the modern Latter-day Saint temple endowment, or otherwise, how modern Latter-day Saint readers of the Book of Abraham might bring their temple experience and knowledge with them into the text. So first, let's start off by discussing Abraham's appointment as a high priest. The Book of Abraham opens in the first-person narrative voice of the eponymous biblical patriarch. In the land of the Chaldeans, at the residence of my fathers, I, Abraham, saw that it was needful for me to obtain another place of residence. From there, Abraham goes on to frame his record by giving a short but important glimpse into his motives and intentions. Finding there was greater happiness and peace and rest for me, he writes, I sought for the blessings of the fathers and the right whereunto I should be ordained to administer the same. Avowing that he was already a follower of righteousness and one who possessed great knowledge, the patriarch goes on to specify that through his lifelong endeavor to follow God, he became a rightful heir, a high priest, holding the right belonging to the fathers. This priesthood, we are told, was conferred upon Abraham from the fathers. That is, it was a patriarchal priesthood that was previously held by Adam and other primeval prophets. I sought for mine appointment unto the priesthood according to the appointment of God, Abraham further specifies. The theme of Abraham's priesthood legitimacy is a prominent leitmotif that runs throughout this text. And readers again encounter this narrative element later in the book. The overall point is clear. Abraham can count himself as belonging legitimately to the patriarchal priesthood of his righteous forebears, in stark contrast to pretenders like Pharaoh. Abraham's opening frame, wherein he provides his readers with a list of outstanding attributes and roles he enjoyed, unmistakably parallels the self-aggrandizing recitations encountered in Middle Kingdom II autobiographies. These texts were often limited to an accumulation of cliches that describe the ideal character and the norms of conduct reflected in the life of the subject. Sometimes, however, like in the case of Abraham, when its authors considered the story of his life and career to be edifying and satisfying, an autobiography became personal history. Such cases are providential for the historian, who finds to pick detailed information therein. One need only casually review Lichtheim's convenient assemblage to spot the similarities in how Abraham frames the outset of his autobiography with how his contemporaries in the 11th and 12th dynasties do the same. Indeed, no less than the celebrated 12th dynasty tale of Sinuhe, which opens with the eponymous hero cataloging his achievements in high rank, strikes a familiar chord with the opening of Abraham's account, even if it is widely regarded by Egyptologists to be fictional. And I have here on the screen a side-by-side comparison showing Abraham's opening frame with how Sinuhe's first-person narrative is framed in the story or the tale of Sinuhe. But what do the opening lines from Abraham's record have to do with the temple? In fact, the patriarch's mentioning of his appointment unto the priesthood and his status as a high priest holding the right belonging to the fathers at once casts his life mission and his record into a temple context. By its very definition, priesthood, as conceptualized in the ancient Near East, involved the performance of cultic and other duties in the temple. In almost all the earliest written documents from Mesopotamia are found lists of the titles of officials, including various classes of priests. Some of these are administrative functions of the temple bureaucracy, and others are religious specialists dealing with particular areas of the cult. Later records make it clear that a complex hierarchy of clergy was attached to temples, ranging from high priests or high priestesses down to courtyard sweepers. Although Latter-day Saints today typically define priesthood in terms of power and authority to act for God, this is not primarily how the Book of Abraham envisions such. To be sure, the text does speak of Abraham's right to the priesthood, but the priesthood itself is imagined more as an order and a ministry into which people enter, rather than power that people wield. How might this understanding of priesthood in the context of the temple affect our reading of the Book of Abraham? Priestly service in ancient Egypt was prestigious, since the practitioner of cultic duties was filling an essentially royal role, acting as the liaison between humanity and the gods. What's more, temple reliefs portray the king as the sole practitioner of all divine cults, the quintessential high priest of every god's temple. Although the king presumably performed cultic activities on special occasions at major temples, a hierarchy of local priests was responsible for performing the daily cultural rituals in temples throughout Egypt. This understanding casts Abraham's appointment as a high priest in a new and significant light, as his text can now be read as the patriarch's self-affirmation of his rightful status as God's emissary on earth and as a refutation of Pharaoh's misguided attempt to feign claim to the right of priesthood, which would have made him such. Abraham's depiction of his premortal election as a ruler nicely complements this rejection of Pharaoh's claims to priesthood authority, thereby reinforcing and highlighting the rhetorical craft the patriarch put into his account. In addition, this understanding amplifies the significance of Jehovah's covenant with Abraham as described in Abraham chapter 2, verses 6 through 11, by recasting the covenant, the blessings of the covenant with Abraham as described in this verse as temple blessings, specifically as temple blessings. Abraham's role as the intermediary and the bearer of this covenant between Jehovah and the nations of the earth can, with this reading, be understood in priestly terms, a point which is made explicit at Abraham chapter 2, verse 11, and further clarified by modern revelation, which affirms that men and women actualize the promised blessings of the Abrahamic covenant by entering into the restored temple priesthood and the new and everlasting covenant. I think for the sake of time, I'm going to have to skip this part and go to another part of my paper. So like I said, hopefully you check out the fully published version sometime in the future when the proceedings are published. So talking about Abraham's dedication of the land of Canaan, him building altars, the book of Abraham narrates how the patriarch built altars as he traveled from Haran into the land of Canaan. The text describes two such altars, one built in the land of Jershon and a second in the land of Canaan near Bethel. A third altar is implied at Shechem, but is not overtly mentioned. Instead, there the patriarch is said to have offered sacrifice and to have called upon the Lord devoutly. This first instance of Abraham building an altar in the book of Abraham finds no parallel in the biblical account of Abraham's wanderings, while the second one does. Contained in the biblical record is mention of Abraham building altars at additional locations, including explicitly at Shechem, Hebron, and Moriah. The detail of Abraham building altars as he settled the land of Canaan recasts the narrative in a new temple light. For one thing, the book of Abraham, building on but going noticeably beyond what seems to be depicted in Genesis, explicitly frames the patriarch's building activity in a ritual context. Each time in the book of Abraham, when the patriarch builds an altar, first in Jershon, then implicitly at Shechem, and then finally near Bethel, there immediately follows a ritual performance. At Jershon, Abraham made an offering unto the Lord and prayed that the famine might be turned away. At Shechem, he offered sacrifice and called upon the Lord devoutly. And finally, at Bethel, he called again upon the name of the Lord. What's more, at Shechem, Abraham experienced a theophany where the Lord appeared to the patriarch and made a prophetic announcement that his seed would inherit the land. The book of Abraham thus clearly depicts Abraham's altars as places of both ritual action, prayer and sacrifice, and of theophany. The cumulative narrative effect of this, as Matthew L. Bowen has recognized, is that the account of Abraham's wanderings in Canaan can be easily couched in a temple context. As he writes, substantial parts of Genesis 12 through 22 and Abraham 2 illustrate how Abraham templifies the promised land, its recreation as sacred space, by Abraham's building altars at Shechem, Mamre, or Hebron, Bethel, and Moriah. That Abraham's altar building in Canaan plays on temple imagery cannot be doubted. The ritual actions connected to each site are clear enough in the text, and the obvious meaning of the name Bethel, the house of El, or God, further hints at why Abraham may have chosen that site specifically to feature a newly dedicated altar to Jehovah. It was, after all, the site of an important Canaanite sanctuary to the god El, the head of the pantheon. Oops. What better way for Abraham to undermine his idolatrous Canaanite neighbors than to repurpose an already existing shrine? So likewise, the altar at Shechem was built to cleanse the idolatrous nation of Canaan and its land from ritual pollution. The outcome at Shechem is the same as at Bethel. Abraham ignores the prior pagan sanctity of the place and builds an altar to his own God, Jehovah, thus endowing the site with a new religious history. Having himself nearly been sacrificed on an altar at Potiphar's Hill, Abraham turns the tables on his idolatrous foes and abolishes their profane ritual practices by strategically placing altars around and in the promised land of Canaan, thereby recreating and dedicating the land into new sacred space for an ascended Jehovah to claim for himself and his covenant people. Excuse me. Okay, finally, let's talk about facsimile 2 in the temple. I'm sure many of you probably have questions about this. This is one of the more prominent ways in which the temple features in our Book of Abraham. So a word on facsimile 2 seems appropriate to conclude here, especially in light of the explanations given to figures 3, 7, and figures 8 through 11 by Joseph Smith in facsimile 2. I'll keep my observations brief since I'm running out of time, and this has been written on elsewhere. Suffice it to say for now that here we encounter in facsimile 2 a textbook example of the reciprocal relationship that is shared between scriptural text and temple ritual, since the canonical explanations to these figures both inform and are themselves informed by the Latter-day Saint temple experience. As important and interesting as the ancient Egyptian understanding of the hypocephalus is, and I'll touch on that here briefly, I want to primarily explore how the prophet, as an inspired syncretist and a gifted seer, reappropriated this ancient Egyptian iconography to interplay with and provide graphic representation for both the revealed text of the Book of Abraham and its temple themes, as well as for the modern Latter-day Saint temple experience. Figure 3 of facsimile 2, Joseph Smith identifies as God sitting upon his throne, clothed with power and authority, with a crown of eternal light upon his head, representing also the grand key words of the holy priesthood as revealed to Adam in the Garden of Eden, as also to Seth, Noah, Melchizedek, Abraham, and all to whom the priesthood was revealed. A similar interpretation is given to figure 7 of facsimile 2, which is said to be God sitting upon his throne, revealing through the heavens the grand keywords of the priesthood, as also the sign of the Holy Ghost unto Abraham in the form of a dove. The main operative temple element in both of these explanations is that God is revealing the keywords of the priesthood. In my opinion, this seems to reflect Joseph Smith's interpretation or understanding of the wedge-out eye present in both of these figures. And you can see here in figure 3, there's a wedge-out eye both in front of and behind the seated figure on the boat. And in figure 7, the wedge-out eye is being presented to the seated figure. What might we say about the wedge-out eye that could illuminate Joseph Smith's interpretation as it pertains to the keywords of the temple? First, it might be helpful to know the etymology of the word. In Egyptian, wedja means hail, uninjured, and also well-being, or otherwise wohlbehalten, unverletzt, and unversehrt sein. The word can describe the health or wholeness of the physical body, the soul, or even an individual's moral character. In the Ptolemaic period, which is the period that the hypocephalus comes from, the word meant whole or complete, and also perfect, and it appears in ritual settings, where the eib, the heart, is said to be wedja, when the words of the rituals are spoken exactly, that is, properly executed. In Coptic, true to its Egyptian roots, the word udjai came to mean healthy, whole, and significantly from a temple perspective, also salvation or saved in the Christian sense. In the colophon to the Discourse of Abaton, to name just one of several possible examples, we read of the monk who secured pouge entef psuche, the salvation of his soul, for writing and donating the text to the monastery of St. Mericurius in Tebo. Beyond its etymology, we can also say something about how the wedge-out eye functioned in Egyptian religion. In its Egyptian context, the wedge-out eye was imagined as the whole or sound eye of the god Horus, used in the process of revivifying his father, the god Osiris, and so it held a pronounced apotropaic function. In this regard, the eye appropriately symbolized the divine restoration and renewal of the body. But the wedge-out eye was more than just this. It could also represent almost any other aspect of the divine order, including kingship and the offerings made to the gods of the dead. It also appears in temple contexts. In Ptolemaic temple inscriptions, the term is connected with saving and protecting the body or being saved in the temple. The phrase di wedja, which means to give or to place wedja, is used in one demotic creation text as something the creator god does to the gods while eternally rejuvenating them, a usage reflected in prayers for mortal individuals. As it appears in temple graffiti of petitioners, it also appears in temple graffiti of petitioners at the temple requesting blessings. Joseph Smith's syncretistic recontextualization of the iconography of the wedge-out eye for a Latter-day Saint temple setting is thus entirely appropriate and finds solid grounding from both ancient Egyptian and ancient Christian perspectives. In other words, what's good for Coptic Christians is good for Latter-day Saint Christians. With this understanding, therefore, the Latter-day Saints may better appreciate how the figure of the wedge-out eye in facsimile 2 relates to their own expectation for eternal life and resurrection in God's presence obtained through the key words of the priesthood as revealed in the temple liturgy. Figures 8 through 11 of facsimile 2, Joseph Smith left untranslated, commenting instead that these figures contain writings that cannot be revealed to the world because they are to be had in the holy temple of God. The hieroglyphs that appear in both the published and unpublished versions of facsimile 2 appear legible enough for us to secure a fairly reliable reading. So let's read the figures. Translations of these figures have been accordingly offered by Nibley and Rhodes, Mekesh, and most recently Gee, with a substandard presentation of the text offered by Rittner. There is broad agreement in the translation of these figures, but problematic transcriptions of the hieroglyphs in both the unpublished and the published versions of facsimile 2 do give rise to some disagreements. And in my published version of my paper, I discuss some of the differences in translation. But broadly speaking, what you see on your screen here is what Egyptologists, including myself, have landed on is being able to read these figures as. Although it may not be obvious at first glance how this relates to the temple, a closer look at the underlying context of this brief inscription and attested parallels reveals something significant. For starters, the ordering of the epithets attributed to the unnamed deity in these lines, most likely the god Amun, finds near verbatim attestation on the pylon gates of both the Amun and the Khonsu temples at Karnak. The reference to the first time in line one, the septepi, the first occasion or the first instance, is also noteworthy for understanding this inscription as having a temple context, since frequent are the instances in temple inscriptions in which the historical temple is equated with the Set and Septepi, the place of the first occasion. The phrase was also used to describe the Luxor temple, first and foremost a creation site, and a site that has a primary role to play in the grand drama of the cyclical regeneration of Amun-Ra. It was also used to designate the Holy of Holies of the temple, the Set Deshret Net Septepi, the sacred place of the first occasion of creation. The conceptual link between the first time of creation and the temple is thus unambiguous from an ancient Egyptian perspective. Then there is the benediction of the concluding line, which you see here. It's the fourth line down. May the soul of Osiris Shashank live. It is not difficult to suggest the appropriateness of this invocation for a Latter-day Saint temple context. A common theme of all Egyptian funerary literature is the resurrection of the dead and their glorification and deification in the afterlife, which is certainly a central element to our own temple endowment ceremony. By reconsidering this line or these lines from the perspective of the modern Latter-day Saint temple, we begin to thus see both the logic behind Joseph Smith's explanation of these figures in facsimile 2, as well as how the text may be brought to bear on temple ritual and vice versa. This may also explain why Joseph Smith seems to have intended to have displayed the Egyptian papyri and the published translation of the Book of Abraham in the Nauvoo Temple upon its completion. We do have one source that says Joseph Smith indicated he wanted to display the Book of Abraham translation and the papyri in the completed Nauvoo Temple. And as an Egyptologist, that warms my heart to think that we would have had Egyptian relics in the temple, right? That's great. With this methodology, a symbiotic relationship between the text and the temple begins to manifest, so that the Latter-day Saint participant in the temple is informed and informed by these lines in the facsimile. Barring the Latter-day Saints from partaking in this universal habit of religious syncretism as it pertains to their temple ritual performances, or somehow insisting that it is illegitimate, is nothing short of special pleading. So, in conclusion, in this treatment, I have sought to elucidate how the Book of Abraham might be profitably read as a temple text, or how themes and narrative elements might be identified in the text that amplify its relevance to the Latter-day Saint temple experience. Each of the points discussed in this paper can rightly be more fully explored, and I welcome additional study to that end. Suffice it to say for now that this reading both helps ground the Book of Abraham in the ancient world from whence it derives, and provides readers with new insights that may inform their encounter with the book as sacred scripture. If nothing else, I hope it should encourage readers not to abandon the text because of controversies related to its translation or production. While shallow or perfunctory readings of the Book of Abraham will regrettably remain all too common among those who obstinately refuse Joseph Smith the courtesy of taking him even somewhat seriously or on his own terms, be that either out of commitment to ideological priors or just good old-fashioned anti-Mormon spite, that should not stop us from digging deeper into this inexhaustible text that has unmistakable and important ties to God's holy temple. Thank you.
We have a few, a couple of questions to ask. Stephen, the first one, there is a strong likelihood that the Book of Abraham translation contained more than the five published chapters. Can you conjecture that these temple themes run through possible additional Abrahamic texts?
Yeah, why not? I mean, it's conjecture, right? We don't know, but sure. I mean, if temple themes are there in what we have, then I can't see why they wouldn't also be there with what may have still yet to be produced. We do have one statement from Joseph Smith in a discourse he gives in 1841. He says, "I learned from Abraham's record that three personages made an everlasting covenant, and these three personages are named God the First, the Creator, God the Second, the Redeemer, and God the Third, the Witness or Testator." And he says he gets that from the Book of Abraham. That's not in our published Book of Abraham. You're not going to find that anywhere. So there may be more material. And Joseph Smith says they were making a covenant. Covenants certainly evoke temple things, right? And so I think, sure, I think there may have been something there. But we'll never know until that gets revealed someday, right?
Number two, can you address the question of the historical context of the Book of Abraham and the ritual to which it is related? When and where was the book written and the ritual performed?
So I believe that there was a core of text written by Abraham. I think that a historical Abraham composed some text by himself. I think, however, that the Book of Abraham that Joseph Smith translated or that he revealed associated with the papyri was probably a later composition, a later copy of the text that Abraham originally wrote. So it's difficult to say for sure what may have been, quote, the original sort of ritual context of this text, since we have to factor in Abraham's historical setting and context as, I believe, sort of the primary author. But also we can factor in the context of the Egyptian priest, his name is Horos or Hor, who owned the papyrus that later Joseph Smith received and that he associates with the translation of the Book of Abraham. So you either can pick a Middle Bronze Age context of Abraham trapezing through northwest Syria and Canaan, right, going into Egypt, or you can approach it from the context of Ptolemaic Egypt in the second century BC with this priest, Horos, who was working at the Amun temple at Karnak. So there's a couple ways you can go with that. I need to sort of flesh out my thinking on that and see which direction probably is better. I did write a couple years ago at one of these other conferences, actually, another temple on Mount Zion conference. Quentin Barney and I co-wrote a paper discussing the use of the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, in a temple setting. We know the Egyptians were doing that. They were using this funerary material, quote unquote, in temple settings. So maybe there's some connection there to explore. So whether you take the Abrahamic context of Abraham writing or we take the later recension of the text as it was copied, I believe as it was copied in Thebes around 2nd century BC, you can go in different directions with that.
The next question, explained very well, facsimile two. Can you say anything about temple themes in facsimiles one and three?
So I actually do have stuff on facsimile one in the bigger version of this paper, the longer version. I had to cut it out for sake of time, but that will be in the published version. So Abraham chapter one, Abraham is going to be sacrificed on an altar to these gods. He specifically is going to be sacrificed at a place near a thing called Potiphar's Hill, right? So I discuss in the I will discuss in the published version how that factors into it. So you definitely can see some temple ritual elements there. With facsimile three, this is said to be Abraham teaching astronomy in Pharaoh's court. And John Gee has pointed out in his book he published a couple years ago that we know that the Egyptian priesthood during the Ptolemaic and Roman periods that they were given instructions in astronomy as upon being consecrated as priests. So there may be a connection there, but one that I haven't explored more fully. So there's some tentative potential with facsimile 3, definitely something with facsimile 1, which I explain in my published version, and as I said, absolutely in facsimile 2 as well.
The next question, were Egyptian funerary rites ever used for the living?
So yes, with a qualifier, because you have to kind of define what does it mean, quote, for the living. So they're certainly used by the living. That's pretty well attested. And Alexandra van Leeuwen and other Egyptologists have written on this. And again, I have a paper on this. We know that some of the content in these funerary texts are imported into a temple setting, including a non-funerary temple setting. That's pretty clearly attested. But you have to think of what, so using it, quote, for the living, that we need to sort of unpack that a little bit. As, quote, funerary literature, their primary purpose is intended to make it, to have this stuff be efficacious for the deceased in the afterlife, right? That's kind of the primary purpose of this genre of literature, of text. But there's enough spillover with non-funerary settings that we can say, yes, it's being used in some way in cultic settings that aren't funerary or primarily funerary in nature. So that's kind of complicated. Again, I can say yes with an asterisk. We have to sort of qualify a little bit what we mean by that. And that's been discussed by myself and others in other publications.
And the last question, what is the most important lesson that Latter-day Saint non-specialists can take away from the Book of Abraham about the temple?
For a non-specialist, probably one of the main takeaways is clearly the temple endowment that we as Latter-day Saints experience, that Joseph Smith first performs on, what, May 4th, 1842, right? If I'm not mistaken, Jeff, May 4th, 1842. That's just, what, 2 months or so after he publishes the Book of Abraham text and publishes the facsimiles. So I think the main takeaway for a non-Latter-day Saint specialist is to say, when you go to the temple as a Latter-day Saint, you can take with you the Book of Abraham, the teachings of the Book of Abraham, the themes of the Book of Abraham, themes of covenant, themes of theophany, of God appearing to you and giving you covenant priesthood blessings, overcoming opposition, sacrifice. All these themes are prevalent in our temple endowment experience. We see that in the Book of Abraham. So the contents of that book can help inform your appreciation for the temple endowment ceremony. And I think it's not a coincidence. I think there's a direct one-to-one influence there.